Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots. Hello and welcome to another episode of Pod Shots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1989 film The Killer. Written and directed by John Woo, the film stars Chow Yun-fat, Danny Lee, and Sally Ye. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, one of my absolute favorites to have on the show, Mr. Sean Pryor.
Hey, Eric, thank you for having me back on the show, man. I'm looking forward to talking tonight.
Me too. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So, drink roll call time, Mr. Pryor. We've had quite the string of a little Crystal Light, but I've been told, a little birdie told me that you're shaking it up today. So what do you have for me?
Orange juice and vodka.
Oh, just a straight up screwdriver.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I am going with a little bit more of a feminine version of that said drink. I'm going with the grapefruit and vodka.
Hey, no, hey, it's good, man. Hey, whatever works for you.
Mrs. Zelag's favorite one to give me a hard time about. So that's what I'm going with. So I think we're ready to begin our discussion on The Killer.
A lethal assassin, burdened by conscience in a dangerous world. His only way out, a deadly assignment with a hidden secret. Now betrayed by the only code he ever knew and haunted by visions of a violent past, his only hope for redemption is a friendship which could cost him his life.
And the plot synopsis over at IMDb goes like this. Ah Zhang, or Jeffrey, is an assassin who wishes to leave the business so he can take care of Jenny, the beautiful lounge singer who he inadvertently blinded during a previous assignment. Li Ying is the determined cop who will stop at nothing to bring him in, only he realizes that Jeffrey is no ordinary assassin and wishes to help him in his quest. The only problem is that Jeffrey's employers refuse to pay him for his last job, money which is needed to restore Jenny's eyesight. So, this was a film, and I guess that's sort of what it's about, you know. This was a film that you brought to me. This was a film that I had not only never seen, I had never heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen John Woo's American films. You know, with Face Off and the other John Travolta,
Broken Arrow.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that in the theater. Strangely enough, I don't know. I was really excited about it, I guess.
Oh, so was I. I saw it in the theater. In the theater too, like three times.
There you go. So I've seen, you know, the majority of his, you know, of course, Mission Impossible 2. So I've seen the majority of his American films, but I had not ventured into his native language. So what was it about this movie that made you pick it? Like, how did you come across it? What's your history with this one?
My history with it is like this, and it really all starts with Broken Arrow.
Oh.
Because what happened was I had a friend, this was when I was in college, and I had a friend that said, listen, John Woo is making another action film for the United States. It's called Broken Arrow. And I saw a trailer for it. I was like, well, this looks interesting. And before that, I think he had directed Hard Target, if memory serves me right.
Yeah, you're right. Yep.
And I didn't really care too much for Hard Target, but I wasn't really feeling Van Damme at that time. But I'm getting an action film with Christian Slater, who at that time, in my eyes, wasn't really known for action. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting John Travolta in an over-the-top villain role. And I'm like, okay, this sounds interesting enough. The trailer sold me, so I said, let's go. Had a great time. Like I said, I went to the movie theaters like three different times with three different sets of friends. We all loved it. And the friend that I saw it with the first time said, if you like this movie so much, you need to watch The Killer and you need to watch Hard Boiled. And I was like, well, what's those? Well, where are those movies? And he said, those are the movies that, you know, that really put John Woo on the map for American audiences. Like people in Hollywood, you know, they knew who John Woo was because of The Killer and Hard Boiled. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll go check them out. And so I was able to rent them on VHS because this was the era that we were still in. It was still fresh. Yeah. DVD was still kind of new. You know what I'm saying?
I'm sure that was a real pristine print you saw on that VHS because even the one that I saw was not the cleanest of images.
Yeah. And so I watched The Killer and I was blown away. And then a few weeks later, I'm in a French cinema class and the professor was like, because every Wednesday we watch a movie, and the professor was like, we're watching The Killer tonight. And I was like, for real? So it was like 2 weeks in a row I got to see The Killer. And I was like, oh, I was in heaven. And so that's kind of like my history with it. Mm. And that is what, like, you know, just brought me closer to watching more John Woo films, watching his original works. And it actually made me appreciate the original works more, like The Killer, Hard Boiled, A Better Tomorrow, things like that. It made me appreciate those films so much more than a lot of his American films, like Broken Arrow. I still love Broken Arrow, but I love it for different reasons now.
Sure.
You know, like I like Mission Impossible 2. I like Face Off, but I like those films for different reasons as opposed to the original works that he did. You know, when he first started.
Yeah, now one of the things that's interesting is he was, you know, he's fairly prolific there for a while. He, you know, he was doing films either every year, every other year, sometimes two would release in a year, you know, mm-hmm. they'd be very close. You know, some of those are TV movies, I guess. But then he went upon making the project, the Red Cliff project.
Yes. Yes.
Which there's been two of those and they came out back to back, but they, you know, he did Paycheck in 2003, and then he did a few TV movies, video game, you know, a little segment of something. And then he, you know, essentially took 5 years for his next feature to come out, and that was Red Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Red Cliff 2 came out the next year, and then it's been another 5 years and he's in post-production of a film called The Crossing.
Yeah.
That is supposed to be coming out this year. So, you know, have you seen either of those films? I know it was, you know, I remember seeing a lot of hype about how it was so expansive and the vistas in this movie.
Are you talking about Red Cliff?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen Red Cliff. Red Cliff
is never got around to it. It's nice. You like it?
Yeah. Red Cliff is real nice. Like Red Cliff was kind of like his return to Hong Kong. It was his return to Hong Kong and I thought both parts were great. I remember part two, like part one and part two got nominated for awards. Like I think like part one got nominated for, best director. Part two got nominated for, best film and best director. So like that really, you know, brought him back. Now I know he's produced a lot of stuff, you know, since like leaving. Since stepping away from doing films in the U.S. But it's kind of weird because, like, you know, people talk about, you know, that he did TV work. you know, that he did TV work and stuff like that. And I know, like, they did a Canadian version of Once a Thief, and he was a producer for that. And, like, the original version of Once a Thief is so much better than the Canadian television show it's based off of. But the thing was that one thing I always liked about John Woo is that if a project, you know, if a project really pulls him in, he's going to do it. It doesn't matter the medium. When he did Blackjack, Blackjack was a straight up direct-to-cable movie on US for USA. And it had starred Dolph Lundgren. And it was like, yeah, John Woo directed this. And I was like, what? And in Hollywood terms, that scene is slumming. But I sat there and I watched that. And I enjoy. That's the best thing, sans, with the exception of The Expendables, Dolph Lundgren has ever been in. It was that great. I was that pleased with it.
Wait a minute. So, you're telling me that it's better than the cinematic classic Rocky IV?
Yes.
Does it have more messages than the very subtle USA versus Russia Cold War?
No, not at all. Not at all. This is just John Woo. There's no, if I could change, you could change. You know, there's none of that's in there. But it was just, I just enjoyed it. But
interesting.
But yeah, man, he's got a heck of a run. And I still feel that with the exception of like a couple films like Face Off, and which was actually also a remake of a Hong Kong film. With the exception of Face Off and maybe one or two other movies, I feel that he's always been hampered by the United States film industry, then helped. You know what I mean? And so, like I said, seeing movies like The Killer, A Better Tomorrow, Better Tomorrow 2, Bullet in the Head, Once a Thief, Hard Boiled, like seeing those films, like I said, just gives me a better appreciation of how talented he is. And he also had to work with less and did so much more than he did in Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like he's a guy who thrives on having to make do with what he has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he's given, like, here, just go crazy. It seems like it may be a little stunting to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree to a point.
Because some of his Hollywood films I didn't care much for, like Paycheck and Wind Talkers. I didn't think much of those really.
I liked Wind Talkers, but I think at the same time, Wind Talkers, when that came out, it was just, there was so much other stuff out there in 2002 that it literally just got railroaded. You know what I mean? And plus, like I said, it's just, you never know. You can make a great movie and nobody feels it and then just poof. Sure. And like with Paycheck, that was during a period of time where like people were just like, Jesus, not another Ben Affleck movie. And because Paycheck Ben Affleck and Aaron Eckhart?
I believe so. I can look it up now. Yes, it was. Yep. It's another, it's the Philip K. Dick story.
And, because that was John Woo's last American film. And it wasn't a critical or big box office success. And he was just like, I'm out. And he just disappeared. So,
I would anticipate that before getting into the film, that you are looking forward to The Crossing then, because that is a Chinese production. I mean, and that's supposed to be released, this December.
Yes, I'm very excited. Actually, I'm in my chair doing a happy dance right now.
So there you go. Yeah. So tell me about The Killing. What, or The Killer? You know, I was doing that a lot. searching for it. The Killing. And I was like, oh, that's a completely different thing. The Killer with Chow Yun-Fat. Let's get into it. What is it that really does it for you? Like, what is it that you appreciate about it?
A couple of things. One, how the music sets up every single scene. There's like a lot of films, you know, they have a score, they have a soundtrack, but like a lot of times it's just there just to run in the background, but it's not really used to accompany the film. In this movie, the music accompanies the film, whether it's the singer Jenny. The singer Jenny, who sings at the nightclub, singing songs of wanting a connection. Or whether it's just like the instrumental score that's once again setting up every scene, you know, pre-action, during action, after the action, or to, pull the drama in and give you a feeling of, despair or hope. Because the thing is, this film also gives you a lot of false hope too. A few other things that really pull me in. Well, of course, the violence.
Of course, yes.
The thing about John Woo movies is that John Woo movies are visual, poetic violence. And the thing is, like, it takes the use of, like, gunplay and gun violence to, you know, levels above, like, martial arts. You know what I mean? And, like, this isn't gun-fu stuff. I'm not talking about that. That's a whole different other thing. But it really just makes violence poetic and beautiful. And violence is, like, and gun violence is something that is not beautiful by any form of the mean. But he finds a way to make it work. And a lot of squibs go off.
Oh, yes.
A lot of squibs. Something else that also that I enjoy is that there are these mini montages.
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
Like you know you'll have a scene that just happened, and then the song will hit, and there's a mini montage of what just happened for some reason. Sometimes and the thing is, any other movie I'll be like, nah, I'm just stop it. But with this one, I get it and I accept it. Also, the parallels / similarities between, depending on which DVD version you watched,
yeah,
John or Jeff or Jeffrey. Played by Chow Yun-Fat, and let's see here, depending on which print you watched, let's see, Lee or Danny or let's see here, Numbnuts, the police detective, the police detective, they have their parallels, and they also have a lot of similarities. The parallels between Chow Yun-Fat as the contracted killer and the detective, the police detective, one's on the wrong side of the law, the other one's on the right side of the law. But they both go to extremes in order to get the job done. And the detective's boss hates that. And he doesn't get the results that the boss wants. Chow Yun-Fat just does his job, and he doesn't have any connection to his job until he accidentally blinds Jenny.
Yes.
But then you get the scene where after, John, Jeffrey, Jeff's apartment gets raided by the people that hired him, the detective and his partner is department, like, you know, my DVD, it was Sergeant Chang. When they go to John's apartment, before that whole scene, before John gets attacked, John is sitting in his chair. He's had a cigarette, and he's just looking at it burn. And there's just this long ash, and, like, there's a pan. And the camera pans across the outside of his apartment. You can see through the windows. He's just sitting in that chair, you know, with his leg, you know, with his leg crossed. And he's just waiting. You know, he's just waiting. And then, like, you know, then shit kicks off and then everything changes. But when the detectives show up, Danny sits in the chair, has a cigarette, and then they do this pan again and it crosses between the moments that John was in the chair, and then it cuts to when Danny's in the chair, and they're both doing the exact same thing. And then Danny mimics the exact same move that Johnny did right when everything kicked off, before the gunfight started. And so, like, you know, and so, like, they're like, look, these two characters are similar. The other thing, because, like I said, I can go on forever, but the other thing is that this film, so many directors have ripped, or taken shots or stock camera styles from this movie. And I know people talk about Robert Rodriguez, people talk about Quentin Tarantino, but straight up, the 360 Michael Bay shot shows up in The Killer before Michael Bay even used it.
You know what was funny was you were talking about how the sequences where he takes the time to show Ajong or, you know, Jeff or whatever, Chow Yun-Fat, that when he takes the time to show him looking at that cigarette and holding it, that's the sort of thing you don't get in dumbed down American versions of films sort of like this. Now, I know that Michael Bay is the whipping boy. You know, he's the main offense. the main offender. But I think that there's a lot of other people that do a lot of other action films that do the same sort of thing where they don't, they have their main characters be a video game. Mm-hmm. Where it's action, 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 action. Maybe a love scene, maybe something that's supposed to blatantly pull at your emotions. But that's all it is. I think that those little scenes humanize the main characters and allows you to take a breath.
Mm-hmm.
And to feel some buildup and some anticipation of what's about to happen, as opposed to just frantically cutting from one thing to another and going from one scene and then, oh, we have a joke and then we do the, you know, just kind of the modern sort of pace, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And there's, yeah, there's a big difference. It's an extremely big difference. And the thing is that the majority of the characters in this film, they mean something.
Mm.
You know, this, as far as the principal cast, they mean something. Now, like, say, for instance, Jenny, who accidentally gets blinded by Chow Yun-Fat's character.
No, wait a minute. Just a sec. Before you get too far into that.
Yeah.
The first time, I was confused as hell.
Okay.
So they're having this very kind of like Asian James Bond kind of thing. Like, just going in and mowing people down. You know, mm-hmm. just being very cool while he's doing it.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I like this. Like, good on you, Mr. Pryor. You know, I'm watching this and just really liking it. And he gets into a little bit of hot water and they're both on the ground and they're kind of like tangled. Him and Jenny are sort of tangled amongst each other.
Yes.
And he fires the shot and her head whips back and there's blood.
Right.
And, you know, so I put first what, you know, this opening fight is intense. And I go, whoa, why is she bleeding? Like, did she close her eye and then like the bullet grazed her eye? Is that the implication? And yeah. So, you know, I obviously figured out what happened, but there for a while I was like, wait, what now? Like, I don't know if that was the, I don't know. Like, I don't want to say that wasn't the proper camera angle or something like that, but it was a little unclear at the beginning if he had like shot through her and was killing her.
Wonderful.
You know, I was slightly unclear.
Oh, no. I understand that. Like, the first time I watched it, I was the same way. And the second time I watched it is when you see the bang, the flash from the muzzle. When you see the bang from the muzzle and you see that flash go right in front of her face, and I was like, ah, there it is, right there.
Okay.
And like, basically the bang slash flash from the muzzle was so close to her face, it literally started to blind her. And that's why when they cut back her, like, the, you know, like, the, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? It could be, like, you know, shrapnel or whatever from that muzzle flash got in her eyes and, like, you know, basically blinded her. And that's why, like, her face is bloodied.
Sure, okay, sure.
You know what I mean? Plus, they also have to do that to give it more of a personal effect, to make you realize, hey, something bad just really happened to this woman.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to play that up. They really, really have to. They truly have to play that up. And a lot of times in Hong Kong cinema, things like that do get played up because the violence is so strong. Something like that, you have to have something like that to really make her character seem in a tragic situation. Otherwise, you're like, oh, she'll be okay. And so that's why, you know, like she's basically bleeding from the eyes because of the muzzle flash / shrapnel. And then he pulls her in and like he takes his scarf and wraps it around her eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So then when they cut to like a little while later and he takes her back to her house because time has elapsed. He's been keeping an eye on her from afar because he feels guilty for what he did. And this is when you start to see the change in Chow Yun-Fat's character where, yeah, he's a mercenary, but he doesn't, just because he's a mercenary doesn't mean that he wants innocent people to die and he doesn't want innocent people to get hurt. And he always, and you can kind of get this feeling that he always like liked her from afar anyway, but because his career path was something that shouldn't cross with hers, you know, he's just like, you know, I'm just going to look at you from afar, but now he's like, okay, I have to take care of her.
Sure, you're right, yes.
You know what I mean? So, like, it kind of changes the way he does what he does, and that's why he says, I want that last job, because his manager, in the original version, well, I'm sorry, the Cantonese language, it's Fung Se, but in some of the subtitle prints, his name is Sidney Fong. So when Chow Yun-Fat's character, John or Jeff, is talking with Sidney, he's like, yo, I need this last job, $1.5 million, I'll do it because I'm going to go take care of Jenny, and I'm out. And then this is where you get, even before I even get to that, the thing is, that I remember the first, like, it's been a while since I watched this. It's probably been about 3 years. I thought all that setup to where Jenny goes blind, mm-hmm. I thought that was like 20 minutes. That's like the first 8 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it goes very quick.
Yeah, this movie moves fast for an hour 50. I mean, it moves. It doesn't stop moving. Even when you think it's slowing down, no, it keeps moving. But this movie is about relationships, friendships.
It's about respect and honor.
Oh, yeah, definitely on respect and honor. And because Sydney's character, like I said, he's the manager. He's Chow Yun-Fat's manager, essentially. Basically, Sydney's like, yo, this is the job. Here it is. Take care of it, and I'll get you your money. And you know, and the quote-unquote final job he does, Chow Yun-Fat's character, he does it, but there's still some tangle-ups, and, like, the cops find him. But also, Sydney's boss was setting up to kill him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, so then that starts this whole thing. And then, you know, John Chow Yun-Fat's like, goes back to Sydney. He's like, yo, why'd you set me up? And on top of that, where's my money? And so then you have this thing of where the character of Sydney is kind of like this corporate dude. And it's like, this is all he knows. And, you know, he used to be a hitman, but like he messed up his right hand. So he's like really embedded in this corporate life and the corporate life of being like basically a triad manager. And this is all he knows. And this is all he does. And so he just walks this line. And it isn't until, you know, Sydney starts arguing with his boss, you know, the leader of the triad, and is like, yo, where's this dude's money? Where is John's money? You know, because John did his job. You need to pay him. It doesn't matter if you feel that like everything got fucked up afterwards. He did what he was supposed to do. You pay him. Mm-hmm. To which then, you know, the boss is like, no, you kill him. And, you know, and that's it. I don't want to hear about honor. I don't want to hear about respect. And so then like it strains the relationship between Sydney and John. And even then toward the end, that relationship gets repaired, but still it ends terribly. You know,
right.
And then, like, you know, when you get toward the end of the movie, it's when Sydney's like, no, I'm going to get you your money. And it doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to get you your money. And he does. But in the end, you know, even he doesn't really win, you know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's like there's so much in this movie. So much.
There is a lot. It makes me want to reevaluate John Woo. You know, because when I think of John Woo, like I said, my knowledge of him is his Hollywood films. And so I know him as a guy who has really intricate fight sequences with guns, right?
Yes.
And he's got a lot of overt and, large, performances by his actors.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That's what I think of. And then I watch this and I'm like, well, I can see some of what he became in Hollywood, but this is a lot more than those movies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more to this.
Yes.
You know, I want to talk about Jenny and her being a blind lounge singer. And what I like about that so much is I like that he follows her around, feels responsible for her. You know, he's talking to her and he says the line that I wrote here that I've been listening to you sing and I feel like we're friends.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, I'm assuming this would be the case for you, but I've had a few different people who wrote into the show and have said, oh, you know, I've listened to you enough, I feel like I know who you are.
Right, right.
You know, and so I can see where that is kind of similar. And, you know, it's not like I'm like, oh, you know, how dare someone say that, because it's probably more true than it's not.
Right.
But it's just, you know, it was an interesting thing that I had on my brain when I was watching this, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But I really like their relationship. And, you know, this is a spoiler thing, and I want to skip forward with her storyline before we talk about the two men a little bit more.
Yeah, sure.
But I do like how she is in the middle, and they use the fact that she can't see very effectively when they are dancing around her and lying to her and telling her what's going on. And, you know, they're basically trying to spare her the bother of knowing what the truth of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And they try to hold off as long as possible, mm-hmm. until John, Jeff, or Chow Yun-Fat's character, takes off. In between that confrontation between him and the detective and the sergeant. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, Bachalion Fest, like, he takes off to try to, like, you know, basically keep Jenny out of harm and to also not get arrested. And then that's when the detective finally tells, Jenny, your boyfriend is a killer.
Yeah. You've been lied to.
You know, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so. And they're like, we can protect you. You know, we also want to protect him. You know, just, you know, bring him, you know, help us bring him in. And, you know, we'll use you as bait. And like, even with that, you know, even with that part, you know, she does the thing at the airport and tries to pull him in. And, you know, he knows what's up. He knows what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Does, you know, because, like, he gets the phone call saying, you know, please come see me at the airport, blah, 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 blah. You know, and we're going to go to Singapore. I can have the surgery on my eyes, la, da, 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 da. And because, Chow Yun-Fat's character is at Sydney's house, because Sydney and Chow Yun-Fat's character have rekindled their friendship, because it was broken. Mm-hmm. It was broken. And, because he saw Sydney beg his, you know, the triad boss. He got on his knees, was about to beg to spare Chow Yun-Fat's life and also to get the money or whatnot. And Chow Yun-Fat didn't want to see that, because Chow Yun-Fat, he was just like, well, screw it. If the triad boss is trying to get rid of me, I'm trying to live a new life. Fuck it. I'm going to go kill him.
Right.
And he almost does it. Mm-hmm. He almost does it. And he couldn't pull it off, but Sydney helps him out, and they, like, escape, and, like, Chow Yun-Fat was pissed, and he was like, he's like, you might as well just shoot me now, because the last thing I ever want to see is you disgrace yourself by begging.
Right. Exactly.
And I was like, yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
Yes. And, yeah, so I really do like that. And her, the way that her storyline ends, you know, and this is spoilers. So for those that may be interested in checking this out, if you haven't, you would be wise to pause. But her ending with, you know, the, I don't know if you want to call it karma or what exactly, but with Chow Yun-Fat's eyes getting shot out.
Yes.
And then them, you know, and it's, I love the way that it's so very Lifetime movie for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, oh, they're crawling towards each other and they're going to have one last embrace, you know, and then you pull back and you realize that they're crawling close to each other and then away from each other.
Yes.
And that is heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting there and I think that a lot of, filmmakers would, even if they decided to go to this point where they see them miss each other, I think a lot of them would see them maybe make a crawl or a step here or there that would indicate that they're not getting near each other, that they're going away from each other, and then they would stop. But I think what's interesting about what John Woo does is he allows them to take a few steps, mm-hmm. you know, like a few crawls or whatever, however you want to call it, but they are allowed to get a little distance from each other, and you're just sitting there watching them, and you're kind of having to sit in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole other thing about it is too, is that what they do toward the end of the film You know, Chow Yun-Fat is a killer who kills bad people, but still what he does is wrong. But you are rooting for him.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, you know, you shouldn't be.
Yeah,
you
shouldn't
be rooting for him.
Like you were saying, he has that sort of embedded honor about him.
Right, and that's the thing that brings you close to him. The fact that he does have this embedded honor, and that, you know, the detective, you know, Danny or Lee or his nickname by Chow Yun-Fat's character, Numbnuts. You know, he's like, I'm not going to let you die. You know, because in that final fight, where the triad boss has brought all of his cronies plus his super special hitman to the church. And we're going to talk about John Woo movies and churches. We're going to talk about that
moment. And doves.
And doves and lit candles. We're going to talk about that. Yeah. But he's like, look, I'm not going to let you die. And I'm not going to, because, like, you know, because Chow Yun-Fat's like, look, I don't want to kill anymore. Until he realizes, he's like, yeah, I'm going to have to kill people. And when the detective's like, listen, you're not going out there. And, you know, Chow Yun-Fat's like, what are you going to do? You're a cop. What, you going to go out there and say, don't fight? Mm-hmm. And then, like, and then he just points his semi-automatic machine gun at a window because he knows a kill, like, one of the hitmen, one of those killers are out there, and just starts going off on the window, and boom, there goes the kill. He's like, you know, I've got no choice. You know, it's time to play. And so Chow Yun-Fat starts doing it, starts putting in work, and then something finally kicks in for Dan, you know, for the detective, and the detective and Chow Yun-Fat, they just team up, and they just got this look on their face, like, they're the best buds, because they were even talking about, like, friendship and things like that before the fight started. They talked about friendship right toward the end of the fight. And because, like, it does this, like, weird, double freeze frame,
mm-hmm.
where they're standing right by the doorway of the church. And they're about to, like, and, like, Danny's like, I don't even know your real name. And John or Chow Yun-Fat's character is like, oh, you don't need to know. Just, you know, just remember me as Butthead or whatever. And then, like, Chow Yun-Fat smiles, freeze frame. It cuts mm-hmm. to the detective, smile, freeze frame. First time I saw it, I was like, the movie's going to end right here?
Well, that would have been interesting.
And then, like, you know, then the fight continues. But even with the detective at the end, you know, at the end, like, I thought the triad leader was going to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cops show up, and the triad leader's like, okay, cool, I got my out. They're going to arrest me. I'm going to be okay. You know, I'm above the law anyway. I'm going to be all right. And the detective comes in, and after he sees, you know, what's happened to John or Chow Yun-Fat, and the fact that he won't be able to live a new life with Jenny, that the money that, you know, Sydney got for Chow Yun-Fat's character is basically for nothing now, all that stuff. And that he lost, and then also he lost a friend. Mm-hmm. You know, who was his enemy.
Right.
Who at first he had blamed for the death of his partner, Sergeant Chang. He just cold blood shot the triad boss, just shot him. And then the whole police department has their guns aimed at Danny. And he's like, I lost my friend. You know, because, like, on my version, because I had, like, the Criterion version, the dub just says, you know, something like, I lost my friend.
Mm.
And so, and that can either mean Chang, it can mean Chow Yun-Fat's character, it can mean both. And no one wins.
Right.
No one wins in this film, because the detective, the whole movie gets, like, basically run up and down by the police commissioner, police chief, because he doesn't like the way the detective does things. He's like, look, I get results done. I do things different. That's how it is. It doesn't matter. And every time the police chief, like, you know, kicks him off a case or, like, basically belittles him in front of everybody, you know, it just makes him push even harder to do what he has to do to win. And in the end, he doesn't win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, his partner's dead. His new best friend is dead. And he killed, you know, the triad boss who they were trying to, you know, bring in for, like, the longest time. But now what? You know, it's like, now what? You know, what does he do now? He has no friends, and it looks like he's going to go to jail.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, you know, I've been on record many times on the show of liking filmmakers and films that take a chance of not having everything work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, and it's good, and it's good because the thing is, it's a great wake up call. I don't think you can make a film like this in the United States because it's going to get screen tested, and a lot of the people that watch the screen test will be like, well, you know, nobody wins, it's not fair.
The soccer moms won't enjoy it whatsoever.
Right, or it's way too violent. You know, where's the humanity? You know, why can't somebody win? And I'm like, you know what? You're not going to win every time. Even in the films, I know films are supposed to be a getaway to get away from like your everyday life. But you know what? It's still fantasy. And sometimes in fantasies, you don't win.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying? Go watch Escape from the, Return to the Planet of the Apes, the second Planet of the Apes movie. Guess what? Charlton Heston blew up the goddamn earth. Everybody lost. All right. Everybody lost.
So, I mean, there's a reason why Empire is everyone's favorite Star Wars.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially nowadays. Yeah. When I was a kid, I hated it.
Oh, did you really?
Oh, as a child, I was mad. I was like, what do you mean the good guys lost?
Yeah.
What do you mean they're on the run? Oh, come on. This doesn't work this way. Cause that was the first time I ever saw a movie like that.
Oh, sure.
You know, where the good guys don't win. And I was angry. But now, you know, not just from a directing standpoint, but like from a lot of aspects, technical, directorial, script writing, all that stuff. I was like, this film is great.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Especially how it was put together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, There's for people that want to get, you know, more in depth about it, there's a pretty in depth Wikipedia page about it. And, you know, talks about how he was kind of struggling, actually. You know, he was not, you know, the head of Chinese cinema.
No.
He wasn't just making a ton of money and being able to do whatever he wants. And so he sort of had to make some deals, and, you know, Chow Yun-Fat wanted to work with him again. So, you know, then Danny Lee was supposed to play the detective and did, but he was under a different contract. And so then they had to involve another company, and it just seems so overly complicated, you know, just to make a form of artistic expression. And what was interesting is, you know, getting into a little bit of the technical stuff is that for the filming, he took over 90 days to shoot this, which was double the amount of time most films took in the 80s, I guess. And, you know, the final action scene at that house took 28 days to shoot.
Lord.
And then the final action scene itself, like not just the house, but took 36 days to shoot.
Mm. Oh yeah, I'm sure, because there's like a lot of things to set up. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, you know, that there's a lot of things going on, and, you know, once you have a take, like, it's got to take a long time to put it all back together.
Yeah, exactly.
And then do it again. I hate to be the poor fucker that, like, flubbed a line. Oh, cut, we got to do it all over.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah, no doubt. And then not only that though, think about like the amount of times they had to try to film the dove landing properly on the candles to take out the candles. Cause like that symbolism right there, when Danny gets shot and then the dove flies over the candles to put out the candles as if a way of saying either A, Danny's dead, or B, bad shit's about to happen. Even more bad stuff is about to happen. You know, it's that symbolic stuff. Like, that stuff is great. You know?
I think he's become a little bit of a punchline with the doves.
Yeah. I think it has been. I think it is too. But now I look at, well, from a U.S. film standpoint,
sure,
it's kind of a joke. But like for me, when I see the dove, that's when I know shit's about to jump off.
Yeah.
Like that's the signal. It's like the bat signal. It's like, oh, we're about to pull out guns and we're about to use a lot of bullets.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, he does use the doves, fairly regularly, and he, you know, he has come out and said that, you know, it's, because he's a Christian. You know, he, you know, he likes religious imagery. Mm-hmm. But he's quoted as saying that the film is not a religious film. Even though they've got all of the, you know, they do have quite a few church scenes.
Yes.
You know, and he says again that the imagery was used to show God is welcoming, no matter if it's a good or a bad man, everyone is welcome. Yeah. And so, you know, no matter the beliefs that anyone might have, I think that that's just a nice sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. It's like, taking everyone as they are at that moment and trying to not bring baggage to every situation and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly, you know, admirable place to be. You know, it talks about the dove symbolism again, which he used in Hard Target and Face Off. And then there's, you know, a cat. It just talks about the different animals that he has and about how in Chinese culture, a cat coming into a home is an omen of ruin and poverty. So those are the sort of things that, you know, I appreciate the never wrong Wikipedia for, for having in there, because I don't know about the, you know, different Chinese, superstitions or cultural ideals like that, you know?
So it's nice to read. Yeah, it's definitely something different for sure. You know what I mean? But it's also nice to kind of get a better feeling of why,
mm-hmm.
You know, why these things are used. One thing that kind of got me, and I didn't know about this, is that Sui Hark and John Woo, for all the films that they did together, and Sui Hark was the producer. Was one of the producers, one of the producers for The Killer. And they worked on a few films together, him and John Woo. Sui Hark and John Woo did not, like, agree on a lot of things.
Hmm.
Like, say, for instance, like, the music is a perfect example. Because if you ever watch Hard Boiled, the character that Chow Yun-Fat plays, he's a cop, but he's also a jazz musician. And there's, like, there's a jazz influence in there, and like John Woo wanted to use jazz music for the opening scene because he wanted Jenny to sing a jazz song, and he wanted to have the killer playing a saxophone, and Sui Hark rejected the idea as he felt that the Hong Kong audiences did not understand or like jazz. Woo stated that he had to change it to a Chinese song, the kind of song they always use in Hong Kong movies. Actress Sally Ye, who played Jenny, who performed the Canto pop songs, did not feel that they were appropriate for the film. The songs were requested by the studio and specifically written for The Killer. Now, the score, that was just like some of the, it's like I said, some of the musical aspects, not all of it, but like the score and stuff like that, you know, they kind of somewhat agreed to it. And like with, you know, the whole use of the harmonica
yes,
music,
yes.
You know. Which is kind of like a ode to Sergio Leone's Western films.
Once Upon a Time in the West, specifically. Which people could hear on Podshots earlier in the year, like around February, maybe? A buddy of mine and I talked about Once Upon a Time in America or Mexico or whatever it is. Thought it was Mexico. Maybe it's America.
Nice.
Once Upon a Time in the West. That's what it is.
Okay.
It says in America on Wikipedia, and it's not right. It's Once Upon a Time in the West. Anyway.
Interesting.
Maybe that's wrong. I don't know. I'm going to quit talking about it. Digging a hole. No, someone's out there going, oh my God, that's not even what it is at all.
It's like they're like personally re-editing the podcast
just
to remove that segment.
That's right.
But no, it's this movie has so much influence on Western film and Asian film. You know, do you get Nikita and then later on the Femme Nikita? Do you get Leon? Mm. Do you get like I said, El Mariachi later on Desperado from Robert Rodriguez? You know what I mean? I don't think you get those movies if you don't have The Killer and Hard Boiled. You know what I mean? I don't think you get those films at all. That's just my opinion. The one thing, and I remember this from looking at the Wikipedia notes, which kind of cracked me up, and I didn't know this. and I need to go back and listen to this album, is that The Killer was influential in on a track from the Wu-Tang Clan's Raekwon. Raekwon had an album, his very first album was his debut album, 1995, the critically acclaimed Only Built for Cuban Links, which is one of my favorite albums of all time. And it has numerous samples of dialogue from The Killer.
Hmm.
And like the RZA who produced the album, he described the themes for the album, saying that like Raekwon and Ghostface Killah, who was like a guest on the album, were two opposite guys as far as neighborhoods were concerned. And like he wanted to kind of play with that theme of like in The Killer, how Chow Yun-Fat's character and Danny Lee, you know, they come from two different types of professions, but yet they have similarities and they have to become partners to work things out.
Mm.
So like, you know, he wanted to play on that theme. And the cool thing about it was that John Woo was so hyped and honored by it, he asked for no monetary return for the samples.
Nice.
If that was anybody else, and if that was any type of American director or anything, they'd be like, where's my money?
You know what that is, though? That's an honorable choice, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a man who says, thank you for appreciating my art. I don't need to be compensated for it. Just the fact that you appreciated it, that's enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? Man. That's such a rare thing, though.
Oh, so much. So much. Like, I got to go back and listen to Only Built for Cuban Links now. I have to, because like that completely went right over my head.
Yeah.
Something that like really the most annoying character in this film has to be that hitman that the Triad boss hired.
Oh yes.
With sunglasses.
Yes. Yes.
Because every time he stepped in the scene, they would make sure they cut to him, and he had this look on his face. He's like, "Look how cool I am! I got the badass gun." Oh my, somebody kill this dude, please.
Yeah, he was, I put the sunglass poser is what his name was. Cause I just, I saw this guy and I was like, oh, you know, this is what having quality actors in your main roles, this is what it does to the material. Because if you have a little bit part and you have a guy that just kind of mugs for the camera and just doesn't seem quite in the same film as this, like, it just seems mm-hmm. not quite right. That's kind of what you get, is a guy that every time he comes on, you're like, oh, somebody just, you know, and it's not because of the character, really, to where you're thinking, oh, someone needs to get this guy. You know, some characters are just really irritating. This guy, for me, was just the way that he was on screen. And I was like, just get him out of here. Someone take care of this fool, you know?
Yeah, he did his job, though. He made you hate him.
Yes, he did.
He made you hate him. That was his job. And I'm like, you did a great job of it.
Good for you, sir. Well done.
Yes.
Yeah. So since we're talking a little bit about a thing that thing's a nitpick, I've got another nitpick for you.
Okay.
So when they're talking about Jenny's inner eyes, and we're talking about the getting the surgery and about how, you know, he needs to hurry and all of this. And there's the cornea bank.
Yes.
There's a place that's a cornea bank, but then they're out of corneas or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? Like, what kind of a business plan do these people have to where this is the only thing we do here is corneas? Sorry, we're out. Yeah, we don't have any.
I'd say it's akin to like a kidney transplant.
I guess so, but it just, you know. But you don't see any like kidney stores.
Right. No, I understand. I think some of that is just through the language and how it's translated over.
I think you're right. Yes.
You know what I mean? Or at the same time, I think they also mentioned how expensive it was. So normally when corneas are available, the rich people have the opportunity to grab them first, before anybody else can. So that's why, you know, Chow Yun-Fat's character is like, I need this money.
It was just, I think it was just like the terminology of it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to where it wasn't just like a specialized hospital that, you know, doesn't have any corneas. As soon as we get one, you know, it's going to be a ton, you know, you're whatever in line. Like, that's something that I could, that I, as a, you know, Midwesterner can grasp. Mm-hmm. But the way that it was translated, talking about how it's a cornea bank, but they were out. And that made me just think of this like little tiny store somewhere that just has all these eyeballs, you know? And fresh out though. Sorry. I just thought that was strange.
Yeah, it is strange. It is. It is.
That goes along with what you were saying about the different versions and, you know, all of the different, you know, the dubs, the different translations. You know, because you were talking about how earlier the Danny Lee character, the detective, you know, they call him Numbnuts or Dumbo. What I saw it as is they translated it as Shrimp Head.
Really?
And that's what they were calling him, was Shrimp Head.
What was his actual name in the movie? Did they give him an actual name or they just kept calling him Shrimp Head?
Well, his name was, I think it said Li Ying.
Okay, see, you got Li Ying. See, like, my version they had, hold on one second, let me pull my notes back up. They had it, like, if I remember right, they were calling him Danny.
Okay, yeah, you were saying Danny. I mean, that's the actor name as well, so.
Right. So, it was weird. They could have even called him Detective Lee, or they could have called him Danny. I can't remember either way. They may have called him Lee, but it's weird because there were like a lot of different versions of this, on DVD, and a lot of them, some of them are out of print. But like, say, for instance, there was a Criterion Collection back in, there's a Criterion Collection. That's the one I have. And then I think like Fox Lorber, released it a few years later on DVD. And then Dragon Dynasty finally released it a couple years ago on DVD. And now it's a Dragon Dynasty Blu-ray edition. So like, there have been like four different versions of it. But probably the Dragon Dynasties are very similar because they normally they keep their stuff in line. But, the other versions, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny because, you know, over at IMDb's trivia, they said a couple of the things. It says due to badly mistranslated subtitles, the movie was promoted as a campy action comedy for its first U.S. run. Which that isn't. You know, that's not what the film is, clearly.
Oh, no, not at all.
And then the other note was in the first versions with English subtitles, nearly everything in the film, including dialogue, the song, and characters' names were mistranslated. For example, Chow Yun-Fat's character is named Ah Zhang, not Jeff or John. The first ever accurate subtitled version released was the Hong Kong Legends UK DVD in 2002.
Why does that not surprise me?
Yeah, so it just seems like, you know, we can do how many things, but we can't translate from one language to another? Come on.
Yeah. It's weird.
You know?
Yeah, it's really strange.
And
it's
here's the thing that blew my mind, and I want to see if this is something that you know since you're much more familiar with John Woo, but he said that, that he improvised all of the action sequences on the set with the actors, stuntman, and stunt director. He never used storyboards.
That won't surprise me.
Because he didn't want his ideas stolen. And according to the DVD commentary, he prefers to work as an artist like a painter. He wants to show where my mood takes me. And so when he planned non-action scenes, he changed it at the last minute. And so there's a lot of improvised dialogue and you know, just kind of feeling out different action sequences and that sort of thing. And I think that that is astounding. Like, I think that that is such a mark of a confident, polished artist to be able to allow their actors and stunt people just to figure it out.
Right. And not only that, but now it makes sense why two of the biggest gunfights, one takes 28 days to film, the other one takes 36.
Exactly.
you know, like, it makes me wonder, like, I would like to see all the extra film that, you know, I would like to see all the stuff that got put on the chopping block, as far as like all the gunfight stuff, because there has to be a ton of it.
Oh, there's gotta be. You know, it's no wonder. I mean, the film is, was basically found, you know, the occult film kind of a thing. You know, the audience found this film eventually, but I can imagine it costing more than it should have, given their limited supply, just because of the amount of film that had to be used.
Yeah.
And the amount of time that had to be put in to those, you know, to that month for this one sequence. Yeah. And that's a long ass time.
Yeah. That's a really long time. I see. And that's a whole other thing too. Like the power of this movie, you know, got me so hyped. Like Eric said, because Broken Arrow was in 96. And then, so I get to see, you know, The Killer. I get to see Hard Boiled. And like, I'm excited. And during this period of time, I lived in Ohio. Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in like the greater, you know, the greater Cincinnati, greater Dayton area in between there. And so in 98, I'm in the movie theater and I see this trailer. It's a Sony movie and it's for The Replacement Killers. And when the trailer hits, like, you know, you get this party, this dance scene, and the dude's talking, like, and the narrator's talking, and it cuts to, like, this, like, shadow, like, you know, this dude in the party, like, in this club, but he's in the shadow, and he kind of steps forward, and the lights flash over his face, and they say the name Chow Yun-Fat. Like, I jumped out of my fucking seat.
Can imagine shrieking.
I was like, are you kidding me? And I remember, because I was in Dayton, Ohio, and, like, the biggest movie theater in Dayton, Ohio is huge. It no longer exists, but, and I remember all these folks laughing at his name. Mm-hmm. And like, they were just laughing. They were chuckling. I'm like, dude, Chow Yun-Fat's the baddest motherfucker on the planet.
Yeah, he's no joke now.
He's no joke. Why are you laughing at him?
Mm-hmm.
And so like, and it, but once again, it's just all just due to ignorance. But, you know, and it took a few years and they're like, oh yeah, this dude's for real. I'm like, he's always for real. You know, it's like, oh, what the fuck are you guys talking about laughing? I'm like, why are you laughing? I'm like, I just wanted the dude to come and just shoot everybody that's laughing at
you. Yeah, I can just see, you going, oh, you all don't know. He's been bad since The Killer, since way before The Killer.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm just like, what the fuck? What the fuck? You know, so yeah, so like when The Replacement Killer came out, directed by a young Antoine Fuqua, no mm-hmm. less.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, like I, and you know, and the thing is, The Replacement Killers is okay. It's not bad, but it holds a special place in my heart because I was like, yeah, oh, this is it. Like, Chow Yun-Fat is here. You need to go see it. And there's things about it I still love, but, even the fact that like Danny Trejo's in it
mm-hmm.
before people, you know, like people didn't know who Danny Trejo was, even though he was in Desperado, people did not know who Danny Trejo was. It was just like, that's that dude. That's it.
Yeah, he's the guy with the craggy face.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And man, like, I just like that. I was hype. I was like, man, I was like, The Killers come to the United States. I was like, yes. So yeah, that was, it's good stuff, man.
That's good. Dude. You know, speaking of films that have come after this, you know, The Replacement Killers, you know, it's playing on the name of this film, obviously. Mm-hmm. This was, a beloved film from a few directors, you know, quite a few directors, and there had been a few different attempts to remake it. In 91, the famed director Walter Hill was going to remake it and have Richard Gere star.
Hmm.
There was also a different version. I believe it is a different version. Might have been the same one. But they were going to... Yeah, it's the same one with co-starring Denzel Washington. So it would have been Denzel and Richard Gere. Now, I like Denzel and I like Richard Gere. I don't know if I could see... I would imagine Richard Gere's playing the main guy.
It all depends because depending on when this was going to be shot in 90... And like, if it was in 91 or 92... Is either 91 or 92, if that was to happen, Denzel Washington would have just finished shooting Malcolm X. And if the movie... From like what I read was that it was in 92, that Walter Hill wrote a screenplay, in 92, and Malcolm X came out in 92, and that gave Denzel a lot of critical acclaim. I think they would have either, Richard Gere and Denzel would either co-build, or Denzel would have been lead bill.
Well, it'd have been interesting, cause 1990 is Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
With Richard Gere. So I don't know. That would have been interesting. I think when you look at it now, you can clearly see that Denzel could have pulled off the Chow Yun-Fat role as the suave, you know, smooth killer. But yes. I don't know that Richard Gere has that same style.
No.
You know, he would be more of the cop that sort of begrudgingly, you know, has a soft spot for this guy that's outside the law, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how that would have turned out, but that never, you know, came to be, much like many, many different film projects. And, you know, then they were going to remake it again. Most recently in 2007, you know, John Lee was going to direct it, and, you know, the film was going to be shot in 3D, and it was going to be, have some Asian actors in there, and it apparently never did anything either. So it's kind of interesting. Like, you know, I'm kind of two minds, because I want people to find the film, and a lot of the time a remake will help do that. But I also don't want the film to be a lesser version of this.
Right. I can understand that. And at the same time, like, I'm starting to have a change of heart in a way towards certain remakes. And here's why. Not all, just some. Because sometimes it actually benefits us. And this is the point I'll get to. When The Raid Redemption came out,
mm-hmm.
you know, it came out in limited release, a lot of critical buzz, and a lot of people liked it. Didn't make a bunch of money in the U.S. because, like I said, once again, it was limited release. But it did well on video. It did well on, like, on Netflix and all these other places. It did well right. overseas. It did well enough overseas. And it's not like it cost a lot of money, but it cost enough. Well, the thing about it was that there would be no Raid 2 if a Hollywood producer said, hey, I want to remake The Raid.
Mm-hmm.
And so the money that Gareth Evans, yeah, I think it's Gareth Evans, the money that, I hope I got that right. If I got it wrong, I apologize. The money that the director got for basically the rights to remake The Raid funded The Raid 2. So nice. I got a badass sequel because somebody wants to remake The Raid. So to me, it doesn't matter if it's any good or not. Because of that, I got to see a great sequel to, I was pleased. You know what I mean? So if a producer doesn't do that, then there probably wouldn't have been a Raid 2.
Yeah, you're right. So it's Gareth Evans. You're right.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So like, it's a give and take. That's kind of my feelings towards remakes right now. It's a give and take. Sometimes there's a bigger payoff somewhere. And in that case, for The Raid and The Raid 2, wonderful. Other times, it's just a train wreck from the beginning.
So where does this could be a sticky topic, because mm-hmm. you know, in a past show, you and I talked about Star Trek: First Contact.
Yeah.
So where do you fall on Star Trek Into Darkness and the way that it used the opposite of the Wrath of Khan storyline for a bit?
You know. I actually kind of chuckled when I was in the movie theater. I actually kind of chuckled when Spock screamed Khan. You know, the new Trek movies, and this isn't, I'm not dissing them, they're just good action movies. That's what they are. The new Trek is just a straight up action helmer, and it's built for an entirely different audience. And that's the whole point of it. So in my eyes, it's just an action franchise. You know, there's not really as much science fiction in these Star Trek films as there is fantasy. There's more, it's an action fantasy. It's not science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you get what you get. And so like, you know, and so instead you have an entertaining film, but it's an entertaining film that's going to have diminishing returns every time you watch it again.
Yeah, right. You know, and that's one of the things where I saw it once. In 3D,
mm-hmm.
Had a pretty good time. All of the Khan stuff and the switching the Wrath of Khan storyline stuff, I was like, I had like a the fuck kind of a look,
yeah.
You know, like what? Oh, yeah. Everyone around me in the frankly packed 3D theater that I was watching it at was eating it up. And many of them had no idea what any of the history of the films were.
Right, and that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing. It all depends on who you're serving.
Mm-hmm.
And because the thing is that the original Trek legacy still lives, because that's the one thing that J.J. Abrams did and the writers did when they did the first reboot. They were like, yeah, all that Trek stuff, it still exists. This is a different timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And like they literally said that out loud in the film, that right. this is a different timeline. Mm-hmm. And like the only thing that would have made that better is if the whole cast just like looked directly at the camera like an episode of The Office to say, it's okay, nerds.
Yeah.
So when you then get this con movie, like, you know, cats like me, you, we know the history. And so when everybody else around you is surprised, that's a whole group that did not fuck with Star Trek.
Mm.
So to them, it's new. You know what I mean? It's no different than, say, for instance, like, you know, the Star Wars prequels. It's a whole new generation, man. Like, you know, kids grew up on that.
Yeah.
And that's their trilogy. I can't fault them for it. I can't. And, you know, and I'm not, because, you know, you enjoy what you enjoy. And, you know, right or wrong. So I can't really knock them for it. It's, you know, same with, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy or the special edition trilogy. I'm like, a bunch of kids that grew up on like the quote unquote original trilogy didn't see the original trilogy in the movie theaters. They saw the special edition.
Mm-hmm.
That's the version they saw. So I can't knock them and belittle them because they didn't see the originals. You know what I mean? It's all different. And it all serves for different audiences, and everybody catches on at a different point. So it just, you know, and like I said, it's just either you like it, and if you don't like it, hey, it's okay. Because guess what? We got a whole catalog of Trek to look at, and let's keep it absolutely positively 100. Not all of original Star Trek is that great.
How dare you? Every episode is a gem.
Oh, I'm not talking about the episodes. I'm talking about the movies.
Oh, well. the motionless picture.
Oh, Star Trek Ambien? Yes. Yes.
You know, I remember when that special edition DVD came out, and I was like, oh, it's special edition. This means it's going to be good. And I watched it, and it took me maybe 5 tries to make it all the way through.
I bought it.
It's like, I just don't give a shit at all.
I bought that at Half Price Books for $3 2 years ago. Because I was excited. I was like, oh, that's right. Because they basically made those special editions after Star Wars came out with their special edition trilogy.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, we'll kind of spend a little bit of money and put some okay special effects in there to do these DVDs. So, like, I bought the Con. I got, like, Con for $5, and I got the Motion Picture for $3 or $4. And I said, I will give it one more chance. Because I've given that movie so many chances, Eric. You mm-hmm. you don't understand how many chances I've given them, and I've tried to be patient, and I'm a very patient man. And it tries to be a pure science fiction film, but I swear it just gets so damn dull.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm out. And this is why I watched The Killer instead.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back to John Woo, one of the things that I admire about him, you know, and we have sort of his signature, you know, gunfights that I'd mentioned earlier and that we've been talking about. And we have the sort of classic slow motion people falling thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of fun just with the, you know, we have the really quick fire shooting, but then still the old timey slow motion falling, you know, like the falling down. So I like that. And I remember, and I have here in my notes that halfway through the film, I was like, I don't even care how this ends. This is just a lot of fun, you know? And I think that once the ending hit the way that it did, like we'd already talked about, I was like, oh my God, you know, just like John Woo made this for me. This is my kind of ending.
Yeah.
I will never show this to my co-host because she will be pissed.
You know, yeah.
Everything has to end nice for her. Yeah. But I, you know, I love that. And it just made me think that John Woo doesn't give a fuck what you think. No. You know, he's going to make his movie.
That's right.
And that's what, you know, that's why I want to watch Face Off again. I want to see, I want to see those two guys going completely over the top and doing the I could eat a peach for hours and all that, you know, and just being completely crazy. And he just lets them be crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and we have all the pseudoscience in there and Broken Arrow with like, you know what? I'm going to make Christian Slater an action star. And, yeah. And you know, it didn't quite pan out. And a lot of that has to do with choice and the films that he made post that film, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was riding, that was, John Travolta was at his height.
Yeah.
Besides from the Grease days, but.
Oh, no, no question. Do not shoot at the thermonuclear weapon.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
You know, the more we talk about that, I watched the shit out of some Face Off. I must have had that on, you know, I had one of those, VHS, dual decks.
Mm-hmm.
To where you go in and you get your rental for like $5, five movies, $5.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even watch them. I would just dub them onto a VHS. And I'd do it on the SLP so I could get 3-in-1 tape.
Yeah.
And then I would take them to work. And on the slow times at work, we had a little display that had a VHS player. And I'd sit there and just watch movies. Right. And so I remember I must have had Face Off at work because I remember just watching that over and over and over and having to fast forward and be like, ooh, this is probably too violent. Oh, this probably isn't good. Oh, he's referencing to doing some stuff with his daughter that's not right. So kosher at work. So I better move that along. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've never seen either of the Redcliffe films. I feel like maybe I should check those out. I'm definitely going to check out some more of his earlier work.
Yeah. Now Redcliffe is more of like a what's the word I'm looking for? A time period piece.
Okay. Yeah.
Just so you know. So you're not going to get like a character with like a gun in each hand. Two-fisted guns going off. You're not going to get that with Redcliffe. So just be warned for that. That's the whole other thing that I think always used to get me excited when watching Chow Yun-Fat and John Woo movies, because there was always a time where Chow Yun-Fat's characters are going to be double-fisted, gun in each hand, you know, just unloading on people. And not only that, but the gun also served in a way as a fist, because sometimes he would shoot somebody from like 6 feet away and then walk right up to him, and as if he's going to punch him, he would just shoot him again right in the chest. He was like, I'm going to make sure you're dead. Mm-hmm. And like the gun became a fist. You know what I mean? It became an extension of his fist. It was like a punch to the chest.
Right.
So, you know, it's just like a lot of people don't pay any attention to that, because that's the whole other thing too. Like sometimes, yeah, he's just unloading and the dude's just like squibs are going off everywhere. But there were times where he would shoot somebody once or twice and then he's like, no. I got to make sure you're dead. Go in for the kill. Go in for the headshot. Shoot through the chest, the heart, all that stuff. And it's great. It really is. Like I said, it's beautiful violence. And you know what I'm saying. So, but it's fantasy. So, but the way it's done, it's great. Absolutely.
Looks like I got to give this hard boiled a go.
You should. Oh, you have to. You know. Like when you watch it, let me know, because we'll do a podcast on it. All please right. Believe, because the battle in the hospital alone is worth it.
Nice.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Cause my interest has definitely peaked. You know, I feel like, you know, like I said earlier, I don't know that I gave him the sort of proper respect that he's due, before like entering this film. And then after watching it, I was like, well, god damn, like, I like that, you know, so I got, you know, and I definitely did notice a lot of the things that you were saying about how, you know, I'm supposed to be talking to David A. Price about, Leon, the professional.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, there are some similarities there, you know, and Robert Rodriguez goes even more stylized in the action.
Mm-hmm.
Wu does in certain respects. And so I just think that this is kind of the father of a lot of films along these lines. And, you know, so I'm eager to check out more of them.
Oh yeah, you should. You should. Trust me. You'll enjoy them all. You have a great time with them. And, And like I said, I can't get enough of The Killer. I definitely can't get enough of Hard Boiled. I truly enjoy Once a Thief. So, yeah, when you get the time, watch them.
Sounds good. All right. Well, do you have anything else that we missed or anything else that you want to bring up about The Killer before we wrap this one up, Mr.
Let's see. I'm trying to think. I don't think there's anything anything else that I can think of. Nope. I think I'm good. I got all my excitement out. I'm happy. I'm in a good place right now.
That's good.
So yeah, no, we're good. We're good.
All right. Well, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show. You could search for it and like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And if you like what we do here, you could help us out by going over to our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com, and clicking on the Amazon ad over on the right-hand side of the page. If you click on that ad, it takes you to Amazon's homepage. And what I want you to do is bookmark that homepage, delete your old one, and then anytime you use Amazon to purchase anything, it helps us out in the process, and it doesn't change anything for you. So I would like to thank Mr. Pryor once again for coming on and discussing another movie on Podshots. For those that may want to dig into the archives, which you can find again over at our website, Sean has been on for, let's see, Batman, Star Trek First Contact, Moon, Lucky Number 11. Is that all of them? I think this is number five, right?
Yeah, this would be number five, yes.
Well, there you go. I think you're like in the top two or three of people that I've had on here, believe it or not. So there you go. But yeah. If people wanted to hear more from you, where could they do so?
You can go to hhwlod.com and you can get the Black Box Podcast. It's a podcast that I've been doing for almost 5 years. The entire catalog is up on iTunes. You can also you can connect through the RSS feed via the hhlod.com website. You can go to iTunes, type in Black Box Podcast, and when you look, because there's a couple podcasts called Black Box, but you'll see a picture that says hhwlod, and then underneath it says like Black Box Podcast. So you can get it there at those two places. Like I said, it's a podcast. It talks about a little bit of everything. Started off just as about comics and cartoons. Then it became more about pop culture as a whole. We got into a big hip hop kick, so we talk about music a lot nowadays. But now really my goal now is to continue to talk about music, things that interest me and the times I get to actually make the podcast, and also introduce the world to new comic book creators, whether it be writers, artists, and stuff like that. So it's a footloose and fancy free podcast. I don't get to do it as often as I like to. But the entire catalog is on iTunes. The entire catalog is on our RSS feed. And so are episodes of Tales from the Attic, hosted by Donnie Salvo. And when John Carroll used to have time to do it, Carroll Chronicles. So you can check there, hhwlod.com, or go to iTunes, type in Black Box Podcast. You can go to Action Lab Entertainment. I am the vice president of Action Lab. And also, the director of digital development, actionlabcomics.com, or you can go to Comixology, click on the Action Lab logo, and you will see both of our lines, Action Lab and Action Lab Danger Zone, and you can get a ton of cool comic books for 99 cents an issue. And, there you have it.
Well, there you go. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.随同伴使这心莫再漂泊，愿那一天你来临时，
轻轻给我你的接受，给我知道眼眸里的人承诺的一切永没改变。多少期望，多少梦，皆因心里多顾忌。即使期望多飘渺，期望已能令我跨进未来，没有得到我愿寻求，得到的怎会不接受？尽管想拥有，但却只能期待，始终浅醉在心里。
天一天，浅醉过一生。